those moral dilemmas and espionage, that you're having to tell these sources that they're going to be okay, that we're going to be able to protect them and we're going to be able to save their lives if they get into trouble. But in reality, you can't a lot of times. And so, especially at CIA, the threshold is extremely high for an asset to be resettled.
Welcome to the Live Drop. Brittany Butler is a former CIA targeting officer with firsthand knowledge in the recruitment and handling of spies and dismantling of terrorist networks abroad. She's a staunch advocate of Middle Eastern women's rights. Brittany has worked to protect the rights of disenfranchised Afghan women and girls and works within her local community to resettle Afghan refugees. The first in a series, The Syndicate Spy, combines facts with fiction of how female intelligence officers utilize both intellect and skills to see beyond religious and cultural barriers in order to bring peace to this war-torn region. Begin transmission now. Refugees have some dental issues.
Major dental issues. Some of these people have never seen a dentist before in their whole life, and they're 45 years old. And so you can imagine the work that would need to be done. And so a lot of the dentists here are like, oh gosh, I could do this, but it's going to cost, you know, $800 just for a cleaning. And I'm not sure I have the time to dedicate to that. So we're trying to find dentists right now that will just dedicate some time and some hours to fixing these poor people's teeth.
In the Charleston area. So yeah. I'm assuming some refugees from Afghanistan have settled in that area. Are there any other areas that you were working with?
Yeah. So the Lutheran Services, they have offices kind of all over South Carolina and North Carolina. And they just opened up the Charleston office. But they have offices in Raleigh, Columbia, Myrtle Beach. They've kind of expanded their efforts with what happened in Afghanistan with the withdrawal and everything. And so, you know, they've been working since World War II on basically like helping to resettle refugees in the United
States. What's the organization called?
Lutheran Services of the Carolinas. Okay. Yeah. And they get, you know, government funding to, you know, for their program. But and that comes through the State Department. But this is kind of the grassroots organizations. This is the organization that does the work on the ground with the refugees. So,
oh wow,
yeah. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. That was going to be my last question, like what you're doing to assist the people in Afghanistan. But we got right off to it. So you're a Kim Dowler, your publicist. She does a wonderful job. This is great.
Oh, good. Wonderful.
Putting some questions together and I realized, they have a little Ask Brittany Butler section here, you know, questions to ask. So it's good. I started reading the book. I'm about halfway through it. And I think that's probably a good thing. This is my excuse, is because I have a tendency when I talk about this to kind of spoiler and talk about things that happen later in the book. So this might be actually a good experience. So I have questions and about what happens.
you don't have
to answer yet.
Well, there's some really good twists and turns. So you have a lot to look forward to.
Oh, good. And I'm definitely hooked in the beginning. That's for sure. I like the character Juliet and Miriam, and they have kind of an unusual handler asset relationship. Could you maybe comment on this?
Yeah, so I would say that in the real work of espionage, it can be very blurred because naturally, as you run sources, as you start to build a rapport with the source, you are building a relationship with a human, right? I mean, you're building a friendship with an individual. And so naturally, it's hard to be completely disconnected from that, what happens to that person. I mean, your job as their handler is to make sure nothing bad happens to them. So you are constantly trying to make sure they're doing everything they can not to get caught while they're collecting information for you. And that with the handler asset relationship, I think it can be very complicated at times. And I think there's a lot of moral dilemmas and espionage that a lot of intel officers grapple with, both male and female, about you're having to tell these people to entrust their lives in your hands, and you are responsible for keeping them safe. You want to push their access. You want them to collect certain pieces of intelligence, but you need to make sure they do it in a safe way. And it can be a very fine line between pushing the access and making sure they don't get killed. And I think that's kind of the reason why I've gotten so involved in the Afghan refugee program here in the Carolinas, because when we withdrew from Afghanistan, my last assignment at the Counterterrorism Center and at CIA was in Afghanistan and Pakistan division. And, you know, we build partnerships over those, you know, decades that we were in Afghanistan with people who were combating the Taliban and working against Al-Qaeda. And I felt like we had a commitment to uphold our end of the bargain and trying to, you know, keep them safe, keep them from harm, because they are the ones who helped us to defeat Al-Qaeda after 9/11. And in withdrawing from the country, you know, we really did them a disservice in the way that we did, I believe. I think there was probably a better way to go about that. And so I like to think that I'm honoring a commitment to these people that we were able to evacuate from the country, and helping them to resettle in our country, to make sure that they're able to live, you know, successful lives here, because they can't in Afghanistan. And so in my writing, in my book, I wanted to explore those moral dilemmas in espionage, that you're having to tell these sources that they're going to be okay, that we're going to be able to protect them, and we're going to be able to save their lives if they get into trouble. But in reality, you can't a lot of times. And so, especially at CIA, the threshold is extremely high for an asset to be resettled. I mean, they have to provide the utmost intelligence, like really high level stuff, in order for us to commit funds and do all the logistics and everything that's required to resettle a source and their family outside of the country so that they're not in harm's way. And, you know, there's just some bad stories where, you know, a source gets burned and, you know, you feel responsible for that. You carry that on your conscience. Okay. So I wanted to explore that in the book and how that those lines are blurred, you know, a lot of times in the reality of running sources.
You mentioned, you know, Miriam and Juliet, where, I mean, Juliet had pitched Miriam, and she's from the Saudi royal family. And, but she said, yeah, but we're friends. And I thought, well, I haven't really seen that in a spy novel recently, where people said, but we're friends, you know? And I guess what's poignant is that, you know, a friendship isn't just people agreeing in the moment that they're friends. It's what you do in the future to kind of, you know, continue that trust and continue that support. And it's inspiring that you're continuing to do that work. So I wanted to get into your writing a little bit as well, from the point of view of a female. And let's see, there's one question here. With 15% of the CIA being female, what was your experience as a woman working in this primarily male organization?
So I think that's kind of like a two-part answer, because I think on one hand, you're grappling with this idea, this kind of false idea, especially in running sources and operating in the Middle East, that female intelligence officers are the way that they're personified in TV and film. And by that, I mean, a lot of the TV and film that you'll watch about female intelligence officers, they're these like sexual dominatrixes that, you know, use sex to obtain information, or they use a honey trap, what we call a honey trap operation, to, you know, basically lure a source into providing information they wouldn't otherwise provide. And when I went over to the Middle East and I sat down with, you know, terrorists, they would be very jarred, first of all, by seeing an American female. They'd never met an American female, but then also like an intelligence officer. And because they've seen, you know, what we see on TV, like you think about Homeland, right? So the main character in Homeland, Carrie Mathison, she's like sleeping with the terrorists that she's hunting. She's bipolar. I mean, it's just like really wacky. And I felt really passionate.
Well, she's also a lead on a TV show. So there's certain pressures to entertain, yeah. I guess. But yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And like, I get that. I just, it's funny how like you will never see James Bond like whoring himself out like that to get information. Like, he's doing it because that's what he wants to do. It's not, I just feel like they do an injustice to female intelligence officers, because we use the same intellect, we use the same tradecraft, we use the same techniques to obtain information from our sources, and it's not all about trading sex for secrets. And so I wanted to change that narrative a little bit about, okay, what's the psychology between the source and the handler, you know, like what does that look like? Because that's really intelligence operations. It's not what you'll see in the movies about like the car chases and the gunfights and all this stuff. Operations is that case officer asset relationship. That's what we call an operation. It's gathering information through your handling of sources. So to me, that was a more interesting story to tell about like the female perspective and how we're doing that, and the challenges that we have to overcome and operating in an environment like that. So, you know, in the Arab world, especially, it was very difficult to operate because they're from a completely different culture where women are not treated as their equal. And so you have to, particularly when you're like handling sources in that arena, you have to establish your authority really fast. And you have to make sure that they understand that you know everything about them, that you know every detail about their access, so that they don't try to, feed you false information. And that, you know, you have to make sure.
How do you do that? How do you, this seems like such a challenging thing. Like, they're seeing a woman for the first time. I'm assuming you're not wearing a hijab or a, you know, or kind of decked out like that. Like, how do you establish kind of authority in those situations?
Well, I mean, honestly, just by what I just said, like, you know, you make sure that they know that you know more about them anyone else in the room. Right. So like you'd catch a guy off guard by saying, listen, I know your best friend from childhood. I know what your mother calls you, the nickname. I know the color of your cousin's eyes. I know what car you drive. So there's no bullshitting you.
Oh, that,
you
know, gets that, people's attention.
That's kind of, establishing the authority that you know the most in the room. And there's no getting around that. He can't, you know, bullshit you and say, I don't have access to this guy. I don't know that person. I don't know about this attack, because you're trickling in these tidbits of information that establishes that you know what they know, and you know when they're lying. Yeah. So hopefully that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, knowledge is power in that instance. I mean, you might have like a SEAL team with you, but you know, I mean, when you know things like that, that really gets someone's attention. You know, I first started reading this and you describe your character, Juliet, as a former Army Ranger. And I thought, oh, wait, is this going to be kind of like a G.I. Jane thing where some stories you'll have female characters who just sort of assume male roles, abilities, and point of view. And I've seen that, but you don't do that. You have some specifically kind of female, perceptions and points of view. And you also mentioned in here that she had specific female intelligence skills. And I'm kind of wondering if you could sort of describe. I mean, you're in reading some of your characters. I mean, I don't think reading Jason Bourne, like the hair stood up on his forearms, or, you know, she was perceiving these people's eyes so closely and what they were doing with their hair, or, you know, the different shades of their eyes. But I'm just wondering, do women see things that men don't?
Yeah, I think we're overly analytical. I think that we have a tendency, and I think this is a good thing, to overanalyze. And I think in an operation, in intelligence operations, that can be very good, because you might see things or consider things that your male counterparts are not seeing, because maybe they're more preoccupied with getting to the action, getting to the next step in the op, and they're not looking at things with an analytical eye. Whereas, like, I mean, I could just sit for hours and just research the hell out of something. My ground branch, you know, I worked a lot with like the Special Activities Division at CIA and the, you know, of course, the Delta Forces and all that. And they're like, they like want to get in the meeting with the source. They want to go out on the raid. They're not interested in like digging into something and really understanding a person's access and really understanding, okay, this is how this leadership fits in with within the larger leadership. And if we really want to go after the guy that is calling the shots, we need to go after this guy. Like they're not, they just want, just Britt, tell me where to go. Tell me what to do.
Right.
Or, you know, like, right. Tell me where he's at. And, so I think we're better at that. And I think that, you know, especially in operational meetings, when you're building rapport with a source, I could pick up on a source's emotions. I think a lot more. I was like, I had a higher degree of emotional intelligence than maybe my male counterparts did. Whereas, you know, again, they're more like, all right, do you know this guy or do you not? I'm picking up more on his body language and how he's acting. It's hard to, I don't know, conceptualize, but yeah, just being able to read a source's thoughts and emotions as they're speaking to you and to understand their willingness to work with you and if they're being completely truthful and, again, arming yourself with as much information as possible. I think that there were a lot of instances where I saw women excel more in those areas than men because the guys were so ready to get to the action.
You also, I mean, as a writer, you can tell your characters, you describe their internal experience as well, not just what they're perceiving, but like I said, you know, the hair standing up on your arm, you know, she got a wave of a sick feeling. Like there are certain perceptive abilities that are, that depend on your own emotions, like your own personal reactions that may not necessarily have a visual clue, but, yeah. I think that's probably a more of a female strength than
well, and that's the reality. I mean, that's putting you in, I think it's putting you more into the action. Cause you know, you're with the operative, you're feeling what they feel. You're feeling the intensity of the situation because it can be scary as shit. And, you know, even if a guy, you know, I love the Jack Ryan, I love, you know, Jason Bourne, all those guys, but like they're the real guys who do the work, they would probably tell you, like, there have been times when they've been scared, where they feel right. The emotions that I'm characterizing in my book. And that doesn't always come through, I think, in spy novels, maybe written by men or from the male perspective, that they're not really talking about that as much. But I don't think it doesn't mean that they don't feel it or they're not scared ever.
You know, there's something interesting. You talked a bit before about dilemmas. And, you know, this book kind of brought up something that I was thinking about, you know, like Juliet's relationship with Jean-Marc, who I'm hoping is DGSC, and he shows up, he comes back.
Right? Yeah, it's
so I'm hoping. I don't know. I don't. Maybe like in a future one. I think they might find him somewhere. I don't know. That's just a guess, but maybe that's just DGSC, me rooting for the male characters.
Crafty bastards.
Yeah, exactly. So you probably worked with I don't know if you can tell me or not, but you said you worked with other nations, and you combined. You know, you shared information and so forth. Did you work with like French and British? And can you say anything about that?
All of them. Yeah. I mean, the friendlies, you know, that's how intel operations are done, honestly, to a large extent. We all kind of share information and we work together, sometimes better than other operations, especially in the Middle East. Listen, I can't get away with, you know, acting like I'm an Arab. I'm not. It's very apparent. And right. Like no amount of language training or cultural training can prepare me for a meeting with an Islamic extremist. I need somebody from the culture, from the religion to sit in that meeting with me because they're going to pick up on stuff that I'm not going to pick up on. So that those liaison relationships, the working with the Middle Eastern services, are absolutely essential to counterterrorism operations from my perspective. And I would say that they were more important than the relationship with the Brits or with the French or whatever, that we absolutely need those partners to help us win, you know, against terrorists because, you know, those are their number one enemy because, you know, they're the ones that are hijacking their religion and using it as something evil. And so they're ready to fight those guys even more so than we are, and they don't want them in their country. So, I had really positive relationships with my Middle Eastern counterparts and really positive experiences. And I was always treated with the utmost respect. I never felt like they didn't respect me as an intelligence officer. I was always treated really, really well.
Yeah. I mean, if the relationship with Juliet and Miriam is any indication of your experience, it's like there's a really high level of trust and a lot of motivation on Miriam's part, the Saudi. She just kind of really freely shares a lot of information. And that's, that brings up the point that they want to get rid of the Islamist extremists in their midst as well. I was looking into things a little bit. You chose the background of this to be an energy war, which I thought was pretty interesting, right? And so I kind of looked things up, like, when are we going to run out of, you know, I went on ChatGPT and asked them a couple of questions, and they said, okay. You know, with the current reserves that we have right now, you know, and kind of assuming we don't open up any other ones, we got about 55 years.
Okay, that's good news.
Yeah, so it's 55 years for that.
Oh, good. And yeah, that's great.
I thought that was pretty interesting. But also I looked into like terrorist attacks on energy facilities. And it seems like we've had a energy war going on for about 40 years. I mean, if you look at the preponderance of attacks, like starting with the 75, the OPEC hostage crisis, you know, in the 90s, there were some attacks. I think there's one in Argentina at a refinery. Then in the 2000s, there was an ABQAIQ facility in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
I guess. And then there's, you know, Aramco and things like this. I mean, I guess my question is, how did you come up with that idea for an energy war?
Well, I think a lot comes down to economics of why we go to war with certain countries and why we don't with others. I mean, you look at what's going on with like China and the US right now. I mean, we're so intertwined economically. Like, I don't think that we'll ever go to, you know, not ever, but I think it's very unlikely that we'll go to war with them because we're so intertwined economically. So listen, first of all, I wanted to do like a fictional war because I didn't want to talk about past wars. I didn't want to get into like any kind of political debate about, all right, should we have gone into this country? Should we have not done that? Okay, what could we have done differently? I didn't want to explore any of those issues in the book because I wanted the focus to be on these intel operatives and their journey and more, again, about the internal struggle that they're going through and operating within this clandestine world and the larger issues that it kind of brings up for them, you know, trying to live their life. Like, I think a lot of intel officers, you know, they struggle with, you know, they're totally dedicated to the mission, whatever that mission is, as long as it's furthering the interests of the United States. But then it's hard to live like a good, normal, moral life because you're asked to do, you know, some pretty dicey things throughout your career. I mean, you're manipulating people, you're telling people that you can safeguard their lives and their families' lives. And then you can't always follow through with that. You're telling the people that are fighting against the Taliban, hey, like we'll fight right alongside you till the end. And then, you know, you're leaving again. And it's just, I wanted to create this energy war because I also thought it was very believable. I can see this happening. I didn't know when. The time frame was always very fuzzy for me. Like, and I really, you know, I did a little bit of research, but I honestly didn't do much because it wasn't my focus to make it about like a particular issue like that, like whether to go to war or not to go to war. But I wanted it to be a believable war that it wasn't like, you know, flying cars and, you know, something way out there, but something that would be interesting and that would engage a reader and make them think a little bit more about the current environment for military warfare and where we're going in the future and what would World War III look like and how all that would play out. And, you know, what would it look like? Because I kind of, about your last question, because I see so much importance with us working with our allies in intelligence, I made the syndicate up because I really think that in the future, it will be more of like a conglomerate of allied intelligence agencies, all kind of like fighting against the same thing. I think you'll see more partnerships, and I think it'll be less about the Brits and, you know, or MI6 and the United States, and more of like a concerted effort to go after these issues. I mean, I think it's already happening. I just decided to name it and make it kind of a bigger thing and create, you know, a more of a global crisis rather than just a crisis for the West or a crisis for a particular country. But what would a global crisis look like? And energy was the main thing that kind of like was percolating for me.
Yeah, it did really, I mean, even though the beginning of the attack on the Abu Hassad compound sort of felt a little bit like a Abbottabad, you know, especially, you know, finding the pornographic CD, DVDs and so forth, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that happened on, I mean, so many raids that happens. That's not just Abbottabad, you know.
Right.
We found that all the time.
The syndicate, though, you can see it happening with, just cooperation between state-sponsored intelligence agencies, or are you talking about like a private organization that kind of comes on for certain projects? I'm just wondering where you think it would come from, this syndicate. I mean, right now we have obviously a Five Eyes agreement, but would you see that possibly as like a private company or just like a...
Gosh, that's a good question. I didn't even consider that. Honestly, I didn't even consider that. I don't even know what that would look like if it was private, because I've only worked in a public sector job. So I would only see it happening through government. And maybe I'm giving the public sector too much credit that they could actually create something like that and run it efficiently. Maybe it would have to come from the private sector. But I really don't know. I would think that it would be more of like a government thing, government sanctioned thing.
I thought one of the things you mentioned about the moral, I keep going back to the moral dilemmas, because you really kind of dig in where some authors really haven't done that. You talked about not only kind of protecting civilians, I guess. I don't know. Is there a word that people like in CIA call people like us who aren't in that? Like, do you call them civilians or normies or
friendlies?
Friendlies, okay. But it seems like, I mean, there's this focus on collecting information, but there's also a focus on protecting other people, because if you give them something they don't need to know, that could put them in jeopardy. I mean, for example, like, you know, your main character didn't want to tell Jean-Marc about this dangerous thing that she knew about, because giving him that information could kind of, you know, compromise her sources, but also put him in danger like that. I mean, do you have any examples of where you had to, or maybe generalizations where you had to actually lie so somebody didn't know the truth? Like, where were you last night?
Well, you know more, right? Whenever you work in the intelligence, in any kind of intelligence organization, but especially at CIA, because you have such a high level of clearance,
right?
You just like know more about a lot of what's going on in the world. So of course there's compartmentalization where, you know, my account, it was Afghanistan, Pakistan. So there wasn't really a need for me to know what was going on in China. And they do that on purpose at CIA. So if, like, you know, you get captured and you spill your guts about what you know, you're not taking down all of CIA. It's just like this one program or operation that you're working on. But if you really wanted to, you could find out. Like, you have access to a lot of information. And in counterterrorism, there was this concerted effort because of what happened on 9/11 and because information sharing was something that was identified by the 9/11 Commission report that, you know, you guys really need to do a better job of sharing, you know, like the national level intelligence with like local and law enforcement. And so there were databases created where we housed more of this intelligence when people could access it more readily and connect the dots. And so...
Is Intelpedia a real thing? Intelpedia? Yeah. I think you say it in your book. Yeah, like database, right?
Yeah, it's a thing. So yeah, you could find out a lot. So I think I had to always like kind of be careful there. Like things would come on the news and I would like... want to say something to like my fiance at the time or my boyfriend, like, you know, now he's my husband. So like, whatever. But I like wanted to say like, I was like a part of that, or I did, but you can never, hopefully that answers your question. But
well, you know, one thing I've noticed just talking from people in the CIA is, if you talk to like people in Army intelligence, at least when I was in the Army, that, you know, people could not wait to tell you that they couldn't tell you something. I'm sorry, I can't tell you that. I'm sorry, I can't tell you that.
Yeah.
One thing I've noticed with people in the CIA is they don't say that. They figure out a way to answer your question without saying, I can't tell you that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating.
Well, because that's what they teach us. They teach you about that, about how to do that. And now, but you want to put it back on whoever's asking you the question, right? Well, yeah, I'm fine. Right. I'm fine. But how are you? What's going on with you? Like, you know, just
right.
Try to.
Right. What do you think?
Yeah. What do you think about, if you had to answer that, how would you answer that? Yeah. Because if you act like you have something to hide, that's when they dig in more and, you know, you don't want to be interrogated. So it's better just to kind of, and the, you know, also like, you know, where, you know, protecting where you work or whatever. They tell you just sound as boring as possible and no one will ask you anything else. But like a military guy might be like, what I do is super secret and I cannot share it with you. But I just feel like I work in IT, I'm a secretary, like, and then it just shuts them up.
Can you tell me about, and this is a series of books. Do you have any, do you have any ideas of where it's going or where Juliet's going to head off to?
Yeah. So the second book, I'm writing it right now. I'm about halfway done. And it's all about what it would look like if a woman was in power in the Middle East. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. You have to read to the end of this book, but I'm having a lot of fun with just what that would look like and the challenges that they would be presented with and how a woman would do that. So that's the second book.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, but I can't I can't get too much into it or I'll give away the ending of this book.
Do you know the ending before you start?
Yeah, I outlined, but there's always stuff that happens during the creative process that I think makes the book so much better that like I haven't even planned for yet. Like the ending for this book, I rewrote it like, oh my gosh, 20 times and it took me 20 times to get it right.
Let's talk about the Afghan refugee situation. And let's see. So you've been. I have a couple of questions about that. Like one, like how did you start? What did you initially do, you know, to get involved with this? And also, like, what has been the kind of experience and reception of some of these refugees in the U.S.?
I think you would have to interview them themselves. I wouldn't want to speak for them about their reception in the United States. But I know it's like, you know, a combination of, you know, it's been difficult, but then they've been given amazing assistance. I mean, especially in Charleston, I mean, the community has been amazing, donating cars, clothes, furniture. People have given up their homes. You know, a lot of people have like second homes here. They're like, oh, just come live in my home, my second home. I'm in New York half the time. So there's been a tremendous outpouring of generosity. But there's also like this balance between, you know, giving them, it's like, you know, dealing. Oh, I don't want to say my kids, but you know, we're trying to make them self-sufficient so that they can stand on their own.
You want to teach them how to fish, right?
Yeah. We don't want to just like keep on handing them the fish because then they just don't learn how to operate in this new country, you know? And so we're trying to give them the skills. I mean, a lot of them can't even read and write in their home language. So teaching them a new language is very difficult. So we've been like relying on apps. Like I talk into an app and then it translates it, you know, and my good friend, she speaks Dari and Pashto because she's Afghan. And so her and I kind of tag team a lot of this stuff together. So, yeah. So I think it's like a combination, you know, they're happy, but then they're struggling too, because it's such a different culture. It's such a different environment. And the women they don't work over there. So when they get here, we're like, well, you got to go to work. You got to put your kids in daycare. You know, we got to get going here. I'm paying your rent. And a lot of them came over without their husbands. And so it just culturally, it's just really different. So that's taking some, I'm sure that's really hard for them.
Have they gotten support from other communities in the U.S. from the Middle East, like say
Yeah. So I think, you know, just like over there, everything centers around the mosque. So right. It's all about, you know, so if they are attending a mosque here, like in they're helping them and they're, you know, trying to help them acclimate to, you know, the new culture, the new, you know, society and everything. But, you know, there's not like a huge Muslim population in Charleston, you know? So I think that there, I helped to coordinate, like this women's dinner where we just got all the women together and that were refugees and just, you know, prepared a meal for them and just a chance to get everybody together and just have some camaraderie and talk about things and try to help each other and tell their stories and, you know, exchange phone numbers and make sure that they knew how to contact each other. Cause you know, not a lot of them knew each other whenever they were in Afghanistan. And then they all just kind of try to push their way onto those planes and they ended up here. And so just trying to connect them, you know, has been good. And then there's, you know, second generation, third generation Afghans that came over, you know, like my friend, who came over after, you know, the conflict with the Soviet Afghan conflict, they came over then in the '80s. So they still speak, you know, Dari and Pashto and all those languages, and they can speak about their experiences and, you know, coming here and the jobs and how to navigate all that. So I would say that, you know, it just depends on where you're talking about. Now, in like Detroit, Michigan, where there's a huge Muslim population, I'm sure they would have an easier time there than Charleston. So I'm sure it just depends on where they settled. And I don't really know how those decisions are made, like why they have so many coming to North Carolina and South Carolina. I really don't know why, but we've got a lot.
Yeah, you're also doing some work with, I mean, it seems almost impenetrable at the moment, but work with women's rights in Afghanistan now. Is there anything that you're doing right now?
I think that supporting the women here has been the best way I can support the women over there. I think it has to come from within their society. It has to come. It can't be me, American woman, Western, going over there and be like, you need your rights. You need to do this. You need to do that. I'm trying to support whatever Afghan women want to do. And so these Afghan women are teaching me about how to support them. And that honestly comes a lot through like money, just giving money to them that they can send to their relatives that are in Afghanistan. They're trying to get books or education, like kind of on the black market, that's been the best way to do it. I worked for an organization called Women for Afghan Women, and they're a great organization to support. They had the number of shelters that they have open right now has gone down, but it's a organization that funds domestic abuse shelters in Afghanistan and helps to, you know, provide a safe haven for women and children who are fleeing domestic abuse situations.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, it just seems like it's a good move to establish these, you know, this diaspora for Afghanistan, where you have these international communities. I used to have family in Minneapolis, and I used to go there quite a bit. And there were so many. There was an awful lot of people there from Somalia. And it was like one of the largest settlements of Somalis outside of Somalia, I guess, you know, and that became it's become like a Somali cultural center as well. Mm-hmm. Like there's ideas that are brewed, you know, given up and those ideas and those experiences and those values tend to bleed back over into the original country, because it's not like, mm-hmm. you know, somebody leaves Italy in the 1920s or something. We have the internet. Mm-hmm. Everybody sees what everybody's doing. So,
Yeah,
I think that is interesting that, you know, you're focusing on helping, you know, women from Afghanistan here who've resettled, because that information will ultimately get back as these communities kind of settle in.
Yeah. I mean, I look forward to the day where I can do more in that arena, but honestly, this is what I can do here and now, and make that little difference.
And so you need dentists, and I'm assuming English teachers.
Yes.
As well? Yes. Is there anything else? Any other?
Yeah. So it's Lutheran Services, and we're looking for volunteers, and you have to go through like a volunteer, you know, a screening basically, like to make sure that you're, you know, not a bad person. And we need people to like help provide rides to and from doctor's appointments. We need people that, yeah, of course, can serve as translators. Like if you know Dari or Pashto, we need you like yesterday. You know, they need help. Like when they go to the doctor, when they take their kids to the doctor, it's very hard to, you know, do that in a foreign language and be able to really understand, you know, certain medical issues. And especially with, you know, these poor folks where they didn't get, you know, good health care for so long. So they do have quite a few medical issues that pop up. So anything in that arena, you know, if you have furniture, they need furniture. They have nothing. They literally came here with nothing. So we've been just like asking for couches and, you know, they don't like, they don't sit at tables. They sit on the floor. So what they like to sit on is, are these, you know, nice rugs. So if you have nice rugs to donate, that's something we're always in need of. Always in need of diapers, formula, baby right. clothes, that kind of thing. One of the women I helped, she brought over her 2-week-old baby, and it's her 4th child. And she's a single mother here, you know, can't speak the language. You know, she's struggling. It's hard. So like anything that we can do to support her, you know, and her kids, we try to do, because her husband wasn't able to get over here. So yeah, I would say those are kind of the key areas right now.
Okay. Lutheran Services.
Yep.
Yeah, I was just reading this book called City of Refugees about Utica, New York. I mean, they originally started bringing people over from like Bosnia, like in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I think there were like Italians had settled there like in the 50s. And then there were also some, you know, some Greeks there. And, you know, it's an upstate New York city, manufacturing town, you know. Mm-hmm. But they've always just been sort of forward about bringing in refugees because they realize the value it can have for a community. You have a lot of communities up there that are just, you know, post-industrial places, but it's Utica is an example where refugees have come in generation after generation and sort of revive these communities. They realize that, oh, they're going to build restaurants. They're going to make restaurants. They're going to have kids in schools. They're going to have organizations. They're going to be spending money. They're going to be having jobs. They're going to be doing work that needs to be done. So I thought it was an interesting book that kind of, you know, kind of explained, you know, the effects of refugees past the moment right now where people need diapers and formula.
Right,
you know,
right.
That these can be investments in communities going forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's so true. That's so true. I think that, well, we could be enriched so much more as a country by welcoming in these people who are patriots in my mind, because they risk their lives for us, to help us root out a problem that was, you know, really imminent for us at that time. So I think we owe it to them to honor those relationships and to help them. Because if they went back to Afghanistan, the Taliban would kill them. I'm not making it dramatic. Like, that's just the truth. They would. Yeah. So I think we got to help them out.
So Brittany, thank you for being on the live drop.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. This has been so fun.
This has been a really interesting conversation. It's gone beyond the book. And now I can go back to reading the book. But like I said, really enjoyed it. Unique point of view, fresh landscape on kind of away from the war on terror, but still kind of, you know, using some of those issues and skills. And yeah, it was a really fresh take on you know, your job and what you did and some of the books that I've read in this genre. And yeah, I'm looking forward to the next one as well.
Great. Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate it.
That was Brittany Butler, former CIA targeting officer and author of Syndicate Spy. She's a staunch advocate for Afghan refugee settlement in the U.S., and you can help too by going to LutheranServices.org. End of transmission.